our next guests say we have a fundamental problem in our society, in our world. We're addicted to short-term thinking, and that makes it impossible to deal with long-term, slow-moving crises, things like climate change or economic inequality.
They also have a prescription, more history, and not just any history, though, long-term, big-picture history that's accessible to the public.
Our guests are both historians. Their new book is The History Manifesto. Joe Goldie is assistant professor of history at Brown University. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
And David Armitage is professor of history at Harvard University. David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, a specter is haunting our time, the specter of the short term. That's the opening line of your book. Joe, let's start with you. How are we as a society haunted by the short term?
We diagnose a crisis of short-term thinking, characterized by quarterly return cycles, by thinking about elections at most every 5 years. And what we argue is that if you look at factors like climate change or global inequality, if you look at the crisis of international governance right now, all of those are issues that static models can't really help, static models about what happens universally. You have to think over decades. Types of change that may take centuries to unfold. And this is a kind of thinking that we used to have in public culture that began to disappear. And so we think that this crisis of short-termism is the result.
And David, you also make the case that the history profession itself also has tended toward short-term thinking in its research and writing. How so?
That's right. For about 2,000 years, history was what one great Roman philosopher called the guide to life. To know about the past was to help to orient yourself in the present and to look to the future. But in the last 40 or 50 years, as historians have become professionals, they become very specialized. And to become specialized, they've had to focus, and to focus, they've had to narrow their timescales and their questions to ever more subtle problems to impress their peers, and thereby lost the touch with a broader public and also with big questions.
And David, is there a fear that if I go outside of my zone of history, I'm going to step on the toes of other people and get things wrong as I try to address those big picture issues?
Exactly. Every historian is supposed to say, that's not my period, and to keep other people off their turf when they try and invade it. And those pieces of turf have become smaller and smaller, from looking like great prairie fields, they're now down to the size of backyards or even bonsai trees.
And it seems like you're talking to two different audiences, historians and everybody else. So, Jill, let's start with the historians. What are you calling on from your peers in your profession?
We're asking historians to think about something that actually the profession as a whole has been thinking about anyway, which is contemporary issues like global climate change. So, you know, if you look at history books that were published for the last 30 years, you wouldn't find that much. But in the last 5 years, historians have started to cotton on to the fact that this may actually be a crucial set of problematics to which we have enormously important things to say, important things not only about the rise of an environmental movement and the rise of the EPA and then the descent of the EPA, but even on larger time scales. When was it with the Industrial Revolution, or was it with agriculture as a whole that we started to produce this phenomenon? And then who should we blame? If we think that it's the Industrial Revolution, should we blame a handful of countries where that factor first emerged? If it's the beginning, if we blame agriculture, do we blame everybody? So we have a lot to say about who should pay for the cleanup around climate change. So we're hoping that we are seeing our fellow historians take these issues very seriously, and they're starting to write as if the public matters. They're starting to write as if the long term matters. We didn't start that. We're merely saying that the profession as a whole has started to realize that they have something much greater to say.
David, that was the historian side. Now, can you make the case that the rest of us, the non-professional historians, the general public, policymakers, should be paying more attention to long-term history?
Absolutely, and this is the perfect day for doing that on the day of the midterms, of course, where we're locked into exactly one of those short-term cycles that Joe mentioned a few minutes ago in a two-year electoral cycle where politicians and those they're pitching to citizens are thinking in terms of very short-term advantage and making sure that they can be reelected and thinking maybe to the next two-year cycle, but not thinking about the huge problems like climate change, for instance, which, of course, go well beyond the borders of the United States and have many, many complex factors going into them. climate change, anthropogenic climate change, as we call it now, man-made, human-induced climate change, goes back at least to the Industrial Revolution and maybe goes back even tens of thousands of years before that. But we have to tackle it in the here and now as a comprehensive global problem with very deep roots indeed. And the crucial fact about this, to sell this as a historical problem to a broader audience, is to remember the great words of Winston Churchill, who said, the further you look back, the further you can look forward. We're talking about history not as a backward-looking discipline or a backward-looking interest for the general public, but something that helps us to orient ourselves into the future, to think about long-term problems and the long chains of consequences that got us where we are now, in order to think about the long future, a future not just for children and grandchildren, but for many generations beyond that.
Well, in your blog, the History Manifesto blog, Joe, the two of you wrote about, you know, ways to try to practically apply these things, and you look back at U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as one potential example where longer-term historical thinking might have been valuable for policymaking us here in the United States. Can you talk about that a little more?
Well, sure. When you hear policymakers talking about wars, they inevitably draw historical metaphors. So some during the lead up to the Iraq War talked about the war as an example to relive the greatest generation. The example would be stopping the spread of Nazism in World War II. Another set of thinkers talked about parallels between the Iraq War and Vietnam, entering a war that has no end. Now, from the public perception, maybe those two analogies bear equal weight. They're both interestingly fascinating parlor games that you could play. But for the profession, we now have, as a result of the Vietnam War generation of historians, an enormous swath of history, histories of empire that draw parallels between the European empires of the 18th and 19th century and their exploitation of engineering and slavery and 20th century empires, indeed in the form of America's presence in Latin America and Southeast Asia. And so we have books upon books that suggest that really the parallel between Iraq and Vietnam is the really clear one. That we are recreating patterns that we know very well, that we can establish and talk about in great detail. From the perspective of the profession, there is no question about which war Iraq resembled more. The answer is quite clear. It's Vietnam.
But I wonder, looking back at Vietnam, there are still debates today among historians, among think tanks and others over what the right lesson to learn from Vietnam was and probably the colonial era as well. David, how do we try to draw the right lessons from history, given that so much of it is contested?
Well, one of the things that historians can do is to lay out a different range of possibilities for thinking about these problems, not to take one example and say the present maps onto one example in the past, but maybe to give two or three different options. So to Vietnam, we'd want to add the Soviets in Afghanistan, or you'd want to add the British in Afghanistan in the 19th century, to look at different countries going into the same places, fighting similar kinds of wars, or you might even want to extend the whole telescope of time even further backwards. For instance, I'm working currently on a book about civil wars over 2,000 years, and one of the lessons of that is 2,000 years ago the Romans realized that civil wars always recurred. They never really ended. They might disappear for a few years and then they come back, and that's a very important lesson in the Iraq War as well. It was what looked like a civil war in 2005-2006. It seemed to go away a few years later. Now it's come back with even worse force than before. So we can see some patterns in history, but you need to look in different places at different times, not just for one-stop shop for a ready answer to what the historical analogy is, but a multiplicity of historical analogies to orient us towards potential multiple futures.
Joe, I wonder how this would play out in practice. Do we need a federal Department of Historical Lesson Providing, or do historians need to step up and be public intellectuals? How would this work?
Well, one of the things that we figure out as we look past the 30-year threshold, we think that this crisis of short-termism happened around 1968 with a turn towards shorter and shorter timescales, both in the public and in the profession in the university. And if you look before that, if you look to what was happening in the 1930s, the 1950s, the early 1960s, what you see is a policymaking apparatus in which anthropologists, sociologists, and historians are relied on as the advisors of policy. So historians rather than economists, rather than political scientists. So culturally sensitive models of change over time rather than static models which are supposed to apply universally to a system of incentives in various countries.
We're talking to Joe Goldie and David Armitage about short-term thinking and long-term historical lessons. Their new book is The History Manifesto.
We continue our conversation with David Armitage and Joe Goldie. In their new book, The History Manifesto, they make the case that we think, live, and act in the short term, and that we need a bigger diet of long-term historical thinking to address the problems facing the world.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you see us trapped in a world of short-term thinking? Do you think it's gotten us as a country, as a world for that matter, into trouble? Do you think we need to pay more attention to long-term history and the lessons it can provide? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Go right to a caller. We've got Nick on the line in Greenfield. Nick, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I appreciate the topic because one of the things that I hear so much is that the media, the news media, presents the news as though the world started last week Monday. A good example of that is the minimum wage. Now, they will report, oh, we're talking about raising the minimum wage from this to that. And then they put on somebody who says, well, that'll kill a lot of jobs. But if the media would also report that the last five times that the minimum wage was raised, it didn't happen that way.
All right, Nick, I want to get our guests in on his initial point there, David, that the news media often acts like the world started last week. Do you see that as you look at the news?
I think that's often observable, that the commentators who are brought on to talk shows, for instance, to put contemporary events in context tend to be generals or economists or politicians, not historians who can say we've been here before or we've seen analogies to this, or in something like the minimum wage, for instance, can give exactly the kind of parallels that Nick just mentioned there, but also to say why was the minimum wage put in place in the first place? How does this relate to larger questions of social justice, the protection of workers' rights, labor rights in the U.S. and in other places around the world as well? We need to remember the motivations for the beginnings of the minimum wage as well as the consequences of its application over time.
And Joe, do you agree that we don't see that kind of deep historical context in the daily news we get?
Absolutely, and it doesn't even have to be that deep. It just has to be a consideration. I think Nick is absolutely onto something here. One of the books that we talk about in our book is Zachary Carrible's book, The Leading Indicators, which is a history of numbers like unemployment and the way that they're used. And one of the things that Carrible is so good at sketching is the way in which our unemployment numbers are themselves linked to social conditions from the 1930s. They are out of date for a non-agrarian society. And the kinds of claims that are made about them all the time in the news, even by the most deft of policy analysts, no president has ever been elected when the unemployment rate is above 5%. For example, that there's no basis for extending those numbers before 1950 because we didn't even have those numbers. So for most of American history, you're talking about making up a universal law on the basis of a handful of decades of evidence. And so that's really it's beyond dangerous. It's beyond dangerous that to reduce all policy information to slippery readings of the present in terms of these numbers without a bigger context. You end up recreating a world that looks exactly like it did yesterday. All of the other horizons start to contract and disappear, and you're left in a world with no change, no utopias. It's not so great a world, and it's a world that we have built largely out of those numbers.
Thanks a lot for the call, Nick. We'll go now to Matt in Portage. Matt, hi.
Hi, guys. I was going to say, I think most Republicans are, we're just generally ignorant of history. Like, we know more about what Kim Kardashian is wearing versus what's going on in history. And I think it's kind of like a Roman Empire circus and bread type environment where we just want to be entertained. We just want to, you know, we know more about food and fashion than we do about where we've come from in our history. So that's all I have to say about that. Thanks.
Matt, thanks. So some blame, I think, for the public there, Joe, in wanting to know about the fads and fashions of today more than the history of the past and the prospects for the future.
Well, you know, I think we would all love to. I think we would all love to know more about everything, and there are only so many hours in the day. But whenever we turn on the news, I mean, the people who are listening to us right now, or people who listen to NPR. You know, I remember we were talking about this book in London, and there was a sort of shocked look on one of the students, and he said after the seminar, he said, you know, I read your book, and then I was listening to the radio, and it was just like you said. All of the people on the radio were economists. No one was interviewing a historian, and he'd never thought about it that way. So the consideration is, what would your day look like? What would your understanding of the news look like if they were interviewing a historian instead of an economist? So, of course, we would say that. Like, you know, we want to hang out on the radio, too.
And David, following up on that point, and Joe's mentioned a couple times the static view that we get, you know, economics often works in immutable laws, as Joe pointed out. We also see explanations in evolutionary biology showing why our culture functions exactly like it does at this time. Is that a problem? Does history help solve that problem, if so?
Absolutely. It can break a kind of gridlock and determinism that's encouraged by the models of evolutionary biology. We're trapped in our genes. We're on certain paths which we can't escape just because of our bodies and our biology. Or the economists would say that we're dependent on certain paths. We're locked into a single future, and we're locked into a single model of human psychology. We're locked into a single model of the market. Historians can say those are just models. They're not complex enough. They don't fit the dizzyingly complex realities of the human past, and that opens up the possibility again of many futures emerging out of many pasts as well, that we're not locked into one future. As Joe says, utopian thinking becomes not just fanciful thinking, but something that's liberating. It allows us to imagine different futures on the basis of the multiple paths that we know that we've emerged from.
Back to our callers now. We've got Jack on the line in Viola. Jack, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, a quick comment. Back in 1981, when I was in economics class in UW-Madison, the professor and I used to argue. I argued for long-term, a look at things and costs and so forth, externalities, they call it now. And he just argued with me about morals and everything. He just argued that greed is good and short run was it. And we argued and argued. And he finally said, Jack, basically, in the long run, we're all dead. And that was the end of the argument. It was all about short interest. And that whole supply economics thing on the Reagan revolution has led us to where we're at now.
Interesting, you know, Jack. Thanks a lot for bringing that up. Joe, are we just so interested in what's in it for us that we don't pay attention to a time span before we were born and after we die?
Well, Jack, the great thing about your question is that when you were sitting in that classroom in 1980, you were living through a historical moment. You were living through a transformation as part of this swing from historians, sociologists, and anthropologists as the major advisors of policy. We talk about this in the book, the people who were advising the planners of cities, the makers of wars, the maker of policy towards China, to economists and to this model. And it was very, very important about the rise of what many analysts now call neoliberalism, a certain form of capital that stresses no regulations whatsoever, that the market is the one just system of allocation. It's very important to that model of the market that there not be history, that we talk in terms of an ideal form of market forces. And as we explain in the book, it's interesting to look at what those people say when they try to look at history, because many of them have written books of history. I think, for example, of Gregory Clark. But they, from our perspective as professional historians, they get the history wrong. They leave out the voices of workers, of the working classes, of women, of And so the numbers that they look at, and we cite many examples of this, including examples by economists themselves, the numbers that they get for what the Industrial Revolution looked like end up massively skewed to conform with ideology. You can look at them again and see that really there's a manipulation going on.
And David, as we start to wrap up, if we the public are going to take this historical long view, we probably need you, the historical professionals, to write in ways that are approachable to us, not jargon-laden, not written just for your peers. Are historians doing this, and are they doing it maybe more than they used to?
Absolutely. We've seen a sea change in the last few years of historians going back to the big picture, the big questions, big data, thinking about ways to present new forms of stories, big long-term narratives about the rise and fall of war or similar long-term complexes in economics, in politics, in the environment, in nature, for instance. I think we're actually on the verge of a renaissance of big history, of many different kinds that everyone can look out for, and it's going to be as fascinating, as riveting, and as important, even as the antics of Kim Kardashian.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And Joe, thanks to you as well.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
We've been talking to Joe Goldie. She's assistant professor of history at Brown University, and David Armitage, professor of history at Harvard University. And we've been talking about their new book, their new manifesto. It's called The History Manifesto.